This is Paul Sandel, Assistant Professor of History at Stephen F. Austin State University and Director of the Charlie Wilson Oral History Project. I am here with my colleague Scott Sosby and graduate student Laura Blackburn. And today we're at the Russell Senate Building. It is March 14th, 2012, and we're here to interview with Kathleen Murphy. Now, Kathleen, I know you go on to work with Charlie in what, the later 80s with defense?
93.
Mm-hmm. Okay, 93 with defense. But before we get to some of your time with Charlie, I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and maybe give us a little idea of what took you to Charlie.
Well, what took me to Charlie was when I met him in 1972 when he was running for Congress. And I was married to a congressman from New York. Mm-hmm. And we went to a fundraiser for Charlie, and that's the first time I met Charlie. And after he was elected, he and Jerry, his wife at the time, mm-hmm. Became very good friends of ours. And we traveled with them, which was really fun. I promise you, it was really fun. And so I knew him as a friend for many years before I went to work for him. And I went to work for him in 1993 after I was divorced. Mm-hmm. Technically, I was really just separated. But I had come back to Washington to work for the Clinton administration, which was not an easy thing to do, I found out. I had been writing and doing TV out in Los Angeles, and I came back because Tipper asked me to, and I went to work over in her office and had lunch with Charlie one day, and he brought Jerry along, and we reminisced, and we had a hoot of a time. And then he and I talked again several times, and he asked me, you know, how was it going working with Tipper? He thought I must be having a great time. And I said, well, if I didn't get a job soon, I would be the only volunteer at the White House who was going to go on welfare. And, you know, it was an off-the-cuff remark, but he took it very seriously. And a few days later, he called me and he said, I have an opening in my office to do defense. Mm-hmm. And he asked me if I knew what a markup was, and I said, of course not. You must be kidding. I was married to a member of Congress. Yeah, I have no idea how this works. But I knew all of the people, and he looked at me and he said, take the job. He said, you're a smart chick and you'll learn. And that's how I went to work for Charlie.
That's how you went to work for Charlie. Well, tell us a little bit about what you did for Charlie, working defense. Was there particular things that, and this is post the Afghanistan.
It is post-Afghan. But what wasn't post-Afghanistan was the need for assistance. Mm-hmm. The trouble is there was nobody to receive that assistance mm-hmm. in the country, so whatever money would have been earmarked for them, there was no catcher on the other end, and that made it very difficult.
Uh-huh. Did he speak of much frustration about that? I mean, you have that famous line for the movie, for example, you have that famous wonderful line at the end about the end game. Did he speak much about that?
Well, he looked for ways to get the job done. Mm-hmm. That was very typical of Charlie. There really wasn't, we can't do this, it's how can we do this, mm-hmm. which is very much kind of the way I think as well. And so we looked at USAID programs, we looked at the State Department, we looked to see how it was that we could help with basic education and especially women's health. Mm-hmm. And there just wasn't any way to do it. No way to get someone on the inside who would be allowed to deliver the services. And that was very frustrating.
Yeah. Okay. Now, what were some of the major, any other issues that you worked on for him? I mean, with defense.
I mean, but defense is the same issues all of the time.
Okay.
I mean, at the time, We looked at ongoing programs for Lockheed. Any company, of course, that did significant work or even insignificant work in Texas, we mm-hmm. tried to help them. Mm-hmm. We did a lot of programs with Zvi Rafia for defense in Israel. Mm-hmm. We did, you know, Charlie at the time became ranking on Foreign Ops Subcommittee, mm-hmm. so that was a huge deal and constant negotiations over what could and would be done everywhere. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And he knew all the players. The great thing about Charlie was that you thought he was being very casual about something, but he never was. He knew it inside out. He knew every living, breathing detail.
Okay.
And he expected me to know it too. And in defense, that was just not possible. He'd been at it for so long, and I used to tease him and say that he had to have a token non-Texan and a token pacifist on his office staff. And it only served him right that it was me. But we had a different kind of relationship because we had known each other for so long.
Well, tell us about that. What was it like then, saying, okay, here's my buddy, and now he's my boss?
Well, he honestly told me many times that I was not his mother.
Why did he say that?
Well, because I'd known him a long time, and I was very blunt. I would say, Charlie, you need to look at this, or Charlie, we need to attend to that. And he'd say, Kathy Ann, you are not my mother. And I would say, oh, well, maybe it would be better if I was. We had a very good and very close and very long-time relationship. Mm-hmm. I would tell you a story, which I probably should never tell for the record, but Charlie and my ex-husband and Jerry and I went to a Paris air show, and this was in the 70s.
Okay.
And Charlie didn't like to be tied down, and they took us, unfortunately, out on one of those boats that was in the Seine, and it's going down the river, and he looked at me and he said, Kathy Ann, do you think I could swim to shore if I dived in? And I thought, oh my God, this is going to be a national incident. So I ran up and convinced the captain to please let us off the boat. Mm-hmm. And he did. And then we had a great evening wandering around Paris. You know, we went to some discos and we got in at 4 a.m. But he really, he was always thinking about something. He always loved to help people. Oh my God, he loved to help people.
Mm-hmm. Where do you think that came from?
I don't know. Maybe his growing up in Texas the way that he did. But he certainly had a really clear sense of right and wrong. And I'm not talking about, you know, womanizing. I'm really talking about right and wrong in the broader sense. I'm sorry, that's my phone.
No problem.
I just need to turn it off for you.
That's
not that part.
No problem.
Anyway, sorry for that interruption.
No.
But he did. He even when I came to Washington, I liked to look at the reason that he hired me was that I was his friend and I needed help. Mm-hmm. And he didn't see how it couldn't happen. He only saw how it could happen. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he was right.
We have a recurrent theme that's come up in interview after interview after interview of how Charlie always says, we're going to look out for the underdog.
Well, yeah, I was a pretty big underdog.
Did you hear him repeat that at any time?
The little guy. He was a little guy when he grew up in Lufkin, Texas. But, you know, there are a lot of really good stories about Charlie, especially how he got even with the guy who killed his dog. I think that's my favorite story.
Mr. Hazard, yeah.
Yeah.
Watching out for the little guy. Now, so being again, you're friends with Jerry as well. Mm-hmm. What was that relationship like? Did he, of course, strike up a friendship with you all because of your husband first, and then that's how you got to know each other?
I don't think I ever got that sense that it was ever, it was just we all hit it off.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie was certainly not a social climber.
Mm. Okay.
I mean, he was very content and very secure in who he was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And loved who he was. And he liked to think of himself as Flash Man, you know, the guy who did good, but who couldn't keep out of trouble.
Mm.
And he made me read the books, Flash Man. Have you ever read them?
I have not.
No, I have to now, because you're not the first one to say that he, that was something that he really did, he identified with. So now I have to read them.
The person who did good, well, sort of, you know, getting in trouble.
Well, having known him for so long, how much of Good Time Charlie is media versus reality?
Well, don't you think that you're always framed in some way by the media? They frame you. Mm-hmm. And no matter if you were to save the world or invent a cure for cancer, you'd still be Good Time Charlie invents cure for cancer. They don't let you walk away from how they frame you.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a fact.
But he seemed to embrace it.
Yeah, of course. Why not? Why not? It was a pretty good frame. Well, I mean, some of it. But no, I mean, Charlie loved to have fun, and he was happy. And, I mean, he had moments when he wasn't happy. But, you know, he tried to embrace life, and he did a really good job of it.
Mm.
And in the meantime, he knew exactly when he had to attend to business. And when it was time for business, it was time for business.
Mm.
And he was very respectful of my opinion and others in that office, especially Elaine and as he called her, Little Laura.
Little Laura.
Little Laura. We all had two names. I really...
Did you?
Yes.
They all. Why did everybody
Except
have
for
two?
Elaine. Because Elaine was way too elegant to have two names.
Oh.
It was like, what was Sue? I can't remember everybody's name.
But everybody would have. Why the two names?
Well, it's Texas.
They give nicknames. He's from California. He doesn't quite
He does not get that.
We give nicknames.
There are things that I learned to say working for Charlie, like, well, we might could do that.
He makes fun of me when I say that.
No, really, you have to.
Yeah, the might have, could have.
Yeah,
or might could do
might
this.
Could do that. So I had to learn that meant we would.
Since you were personal friends, and this is something that is intriguing to someone, particularly wants to know more about Charlie, is his relationship with Jerry. He stayed very cordial.
Mm-hmm.
Even everybody said all the way, you know, through the end of his life, stayed very cordial.
I think he loved her very much.
Is that a... Oh, maybe I'm just... How do you pull that off?
Because Charlie was, in his heart, a very good man. And he was very honest, and he just said, I can't be faithful. And I'm not telling you more than that. But that was the bottom line. And so... It was better to be divorced than to go through and have him be unfaithful to her, you know. That was the bottom line.
Nobody's told us that before. Not that part of it, really.
No.
Interesting. Very interesting. That says a lot about him as well.
He's very honest.
Do you think that was his most distinguishing characteristic?
Oh,
his honesty?
Oh, his honesty, his bluntness, sure. But I think the most distinguishing characteristic about Charlie was his loyalty. I mean, he was unendingly loyal to his friends, without question. If they needed him, he was there. When his really close and dear friend Jim Rooney was sick, Charlie took him down to MD Anderson and got treatment for cancer. He was with him all the way.
Hmm.
And you saw this time and time again.
Hmm.
Loyalty.
Yeah. It's also, I mean, to some extent, that, and this goes with it, and the loyalty, his relationship with, did you see, with other people in Congress. Now, you came on later, but you knew him for a long time, so you could speak before.
Yeah, but my relationship was with those people, too. Yeah.
This is something that I think we really want to get into, but his relationship, who in Congress was his strongest allies that he could go to time and again, or were there any?
Yeah, because he said he knew the players, and how did that, did he have a cohort that he worked with a lot, or how was he as a politician?
He's brilliant. But he didn't, you know, Charlie would do favors for people and not, you know, I mean, he interacted back and forth with people, and he was always very friendly and always right there. He was a good old boy. But when there was something important to discuss, he went directly to them and sat down with them. And, you know, Congress is cutting deals, and that's what they did.
How did he, you know, and having been around Congress a lot yourself, you know there are different ways congressmen exercise power in various ways. To use another Texas politician, Lyndon Johnson could give you the Johnson treatment, this intense smile at you while he's twisting your arm. Dan Rostenkowski was famous for, I mean, trading everything in the world. How did Charlie exercise
Dan
power?
Was a friend of mine, too.
Well, sure, but I mean, that was no secret.
My son
that he
actually
did.
Worked for Dan.
He would, you know, he'd trade in favors. That's how he exercised
power. Well, of course, they all did.
But Charlie seemed to be exercised his power a little differently.
See, I don't really know what you mean by that, because I've watched Congress since I was 20 years old and came to Washington, D.C. I got married at 21. My whole, you know, first almost 15 years of my adult life was spent being married to a member of Congress. So everyone thought everything I had to say was brilliant. They thought it was the most charming, fabulous person on the face of the earth until my husband got in trouble and lost. And then, of course, they had no use for me. It's a different kind of a place. And I don't think Charlie ever deluded himself into thinking that people who were his allies were also his friends. They were his congressional friends, as you learn this. Mm-hmm. And he knew who he could count on, and he could count on Jack Murtha for sure. But, I mean, he could count on Kay Bailey Hutchison. He could count on people if he really needed them. Because he didn't ask when he didn't. He didn't ask for stupid things. He saved those asks for when it was big. He could get the other stuff done by charming a staff person and by, you know.
Well,
and he
were
did.
Were there any particular so-called big things? What were some of those big things outside of perhaps Afghanistan?
Well, I think that's obviously the best example. But I think in any defense bill, when you're real, the way the defense bill works essentially, and it shouldn't, but it does, is that each member on the subcommittee, on the defense subcommittee, is given an allocation. Are you aware of this?
Okay.
So if your allocation this year is $60 million, you get to allocate that toward anything you want.
Wow.
And I would bring projects that people proposed, and Charlie would look at me and he'd say, please don't bring to me another military soldiers to manicurists program. He said, I don't want to hear about it. But people would ask for really bizarre things. And you had to know how to say no. But if somebody came in, we really supported what is it when you use long distance medicine, you know, when you're, they call that something,
telemedicine.
Thank you. It's been a while. But telemedicine programs and looking into how that could be used, but also tying it back into the use of Brooke Army Medical, or, you know, something that had to do with Texas. And he was really good at that. But he also had a great ability. He was smart. And he had a really great ability to understand the real details of something.
You know, famously, I think at one time the Texas first congressional district was one of only three congressional districts in the entire country that had no defense contractors in the district, no military installations in the district. But Charlie used that position to trade off. Is that what he did? I mean, we don't need anything for the district, so I can trade you some things.
Well, but it was Texas. You see, Texas, while the district perhaps didn't have that role, Texas had that role. Texas is one of the most important states as far as defense, with Lockheed in particular, and Bell Textron, and all of these other companies that were there, hugely important, and all of the military bases. So to be on the Defense Appropriations Committee and from Texas, there was just nothing better.
Of course, he had an affection for the military as well.
He was an Annapolis graduate. Mm-hmm. I went on an aircraft carrier with Charlie. What was that like? Well, that was fun. But to stand there and look at these little bunks, and I stood there and I looked at him and I said, Charlie, I do not know how you fit. How did you squeeze your long self in this little short person? He says, well, I sort of... I had to bend over.
Yeah, I've been on submarines, and I still don't know how people ever fit in a submarine.
Well,
yeah, it's unbelievable.
I would be too claustrophobic.
I just couldn't imagine. I want to go back, and this is a question that we have: was he a powerful congressman? Would you call him a powerful
absolutely.
Congressman?
Absolutely, absolutely. No doubt that when Charlie knew something was right and he knew it needed to be done, it was going to get done. In that way, he was powerful. He wasn't Jack Murtha who made people start companies in his district. He saw it in the larger picture always. And if something was good, you know, for the country and good internationally, then he paid really close attention to it.
Well, since you were on his staff toward the latter part of his career, and as the career dwindled down, and
it didn't dwindle.
Why did he retire? Why did Charlie decide to retire?
Because he got tired of it.
And why was he tired?
Well, because you have to look at what happened in 1994 with Newt Gingrich and the contract on America. That the whole attitude in Congress changed, and it became a very hostile place. It wasn't fun anymore, and it certainly wasn't collegial. And that really was the beginning of the continuing non-collegiality you see in Congress today. Only it's rabid partisanship today. Mm-hmm. In all the years that we were in Congress, there were always, you know, blue dog Democrats, they called them, of which Charlie was kind of one, mm-hmm. who could look at both sides of any issue. There was no straight, you know, line. There certainly was no straight line for Charlie.
So with the Gingrich or the Republican Revolution at the time, and I love the phrase "contract on America." I'm going to steal that.
That's true.
I love that. Was he deflated at all with those Peterson campaigns, the Donna Peterson campaigns against him?
No.
He didn't.
No.
Okay.
Deflated. Why?
Well, I guess she was
the poor woman
such
was a joke, and she lied all the time. So why would you be deflated over someone like that?
Well, she was very, very much an attack dog against him,
and he was used to that.
He was used to that, so it didn't faze him at all. Okay.
No, he was much more concerned about Bubba Gross, who won the lottery. He said he would trade places with him.
Okay. So he was never worried.
Well, I think there's a difference. There's, you know, he fought hard every time. He never took it lightly. But at the same time, you know, there was no personal... We and the staff, we hated her, but he didn't hate anybody.
And I don't want to get into something more I know wants to ask, but he's a Democratic congressman.
Mm-hmm.
In, of course, when he started, is a completely Democratic state, but a very conservative state.
Mm-hmm.
By the time he ends, it's becoming an increasingly Republican state, but he is surviving to some. I mean, he probably could have continued to win elections in that district.
I believe he could have.
So, what was the secret to Charlie's political survival, if you will?
Well, the secret to Charlie's political survival, I think, is quite clear, actually. It was called customer service. He treated his constituents like gold. And so they voted for him. Mm-hmm. And people who, I doubt today, with the mentality of voters, you know, wanting to control whether women can have access to family planning, that he could survive in this attitude. But back then, he used to say, my constituents know who I am. Mm-hmm. They know who I am. They know what they're getting. And it is someone who worked very, very hard for them, and he'd go out and play very hard at night.
Mm-hmm. As a person who's been observing Congress for a long time, just in our current environment, do you see that's the biggest change? Constituent services don't count anymore?
Oh, I think every office, you know, attends to constituent service. I think what doesn't count anymore is what is good for America. It only counts on what gets the Republicans or the Democrats reelected. Mm-hmm. And I cite the Democrats too, but they aren't as hideous at it.
And Charlie
as
hated
the Republican.
That.
Well, everybody hates that.
I'm not convinced everybody hates it, because I think some love it.
Well, I don't think it's good for the country,
I don't think
he did either.
Now, you
but when Newt Gingrich took over, the first thing he did was throw me out of the garage.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, what do you mean? Took your parking place away?
He did. He took my parking place.
Really?
Just out of spite?
No, actually, I'm pretty... See, in 440 years, the Democrats had ruled. So what do we know about not having inside parking? We had inside parking. We thought it was just a normal...
Everybody has this.
So the Republicans took over, and the first thing that Democratic staff learned was that it wasn't a birthright, and you have to park down the road.
Well, his moniker is the liberal from Lufkin.
Mm-hmm.
And he got that when he was in the Texas Senate. Was he? Does that fit?
Oh yeah. If you're looking at Charlie on social issues, how really it is an anomaly how someone who was pro-choice and pro-women's rights and you know pro-civil rights the way he was ever got elected in a conservative district.
Well, how do you think it happened?
Yeah.
Because people liked him. Because you had to like Charlie.
Well, did he represent any other base beliefs that would be in tune with his constituents? I mean, in other words, if I were to corner you and say, tell me what Charlie's political philosophy is, what is the answer, generally?
Well, I mean, I think that's a complex question. Charlie always thought about the little guy, and he always was going to stand up for you. And if you were going to lose your Social Security or you were not getting Medicare, you weren't able to go on Medicaid, he'd take care of it. Mm-hmm. That kind of attention to the little guy made him, you know, a liberal with a conservative heart, I guess. I don't know what they would say, because I would say it's a liberal with a liberal heart, but that, you know, people saw him as somebody who related to them on their level. He was one of them. He could talk to them. He knew what they needed. He knew what they were thinking, and he attended to it. He focused on it. And so he didn't come to Washington thinking he was going to run for president.
Did he ever have any other aspirations that you're aware of?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. He liked being a congressman.
Well, he liked going home to Lufkin, too.
Okay. But not even Senate?
I never talked to him about that. So if he talked to someone else about it, it isn't something I ever... Mm-hmm.
It's never come up, just kidding.
No. I've never heard it.
No. I think that Charlie believed that you know, he was really part of the people he represented. Mm-hmm. And I'm not so sure he was foolish enough to believe that would apply across the entire state of Texas.
Fair enough. Okay. So, well, not to belabor the political philosophy point, but he's also very famously pro-gun. And
he and I differed on that issue.
I've heard a lot.
I heard his sister say the same.
She said it just about as you did. We disagree on this issue. Well, so he's also very, very forward about being pro-gun, so not the most liberal of positions.
No, I think you need to look at something a little more realistically. If you're a politician and you're from Lufkin, Texas, and you aren't pro-gun, you won't get elected. So you're pro-gun. Mm-hmm. I think if you had Charlie sitting here where I am sitting and you said, do you think that there are rational gun laws in this country? He would tell you no. And he and I had that conversation many times. And he would say, Kathy Ann, I'm from Lufkin, Texas, and people there love their guns. He was not stupid. Mm-hmm. He was not going to go, you know, running around saying we need new laws against handguns. Mm-hmm. Although I believe if he, you know, if you ask him, he would tell you that he thought that there was nothing wrong with having people have to be licensed to carry a weapon. But he voted the way he needed to vote to win in that district mm-hmm. on guns.
Hmm. Is there other things that you think he took a position for specifically because of the constituency?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
No.
Because on the flip side of the coin is then his constituency with the women's rights issue or the civil rights issue.
Yeah, but guns are different. The NRA would slaughter you. I mean, the NRA gets even. It does. And you don't have, you know, Southern Baptists or whoever down there that are anti, let's say, abortion going after you, you know, for a pro-choice stand in the same way that the NRA would go after you.
Gotcha.
But I don't think that would have changed Charlie. I mm-hmm. think if you talk to Sharon and ask her, she would tell you he was thoroughly committed to women's issues.
And she says that. Does she did share a fun story of a conversation she had, something to the effect that her and Charlie made a deal. I will support women's rights, especially with her on Planned Parenthood, and you leave me alone about the guns.
Yeah, I'm sure they did. See, there was a trade-off, wasn't there?
Yeah. True. Right?
Very much so. Very much so. Well, again, what was it like to work in his office? Not necessarily just with him, but what was your interaction with other people in the office at all? Or were you very autonomous?
No, well, certainly we're autonomous because in every office you're assigned your issues. Mm-hmm. You have to sort of break it down that way. But if somebody was, you know, overwhelmed with whatever was going on, mm-hmm. for instance, when it was markup time and I had the book and all of those things to deal with, if a letter came in that had to do with defense, someone else answered it. I didn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, so we traded off. But it was a very friendly office. We went to lunch a lot together. Mm-hmm. We had a good close relationship.
Is that normal in the congressional office, the legislature?
That's the only congressional office I ever worked in. So it's.
But you were around some.
Oh, I was around a lot of them, but I never worked in one. And in my ex-husband's office, I don't recall that kind of collegiality, and yet today they still all get together, so it must have existed.
Something's there. Hmm.
They don't include me, however. But.
Well, a lot of this has been made, and again, you being over the long durée of his relationship with him as friend to co-worker, did you become part of the so-called Charlie's Angels?
Oh, I was a Charlie's Angel. I mean, you don't work for Charlie and not
be a Charlie's Angel.
My contention was that Charlie liked attractive women around because we diverted attention. And, gave him the upper hand. You know, people were very busy looking at a few of the women who worked for him.
Okay, are you saying he did this very methodically, purposely, saying, I can, as a political strategy or another strategy, to get the upper hand?
Oh, I wouldn't go that far, but I would tell you Charlie was very blunt. He liked looking at good-looking women, and so he surrounded himself with them. But they were smart, good-looking women. They were smart women.
How was the reaction to, how did that come about, the Charlie's Angels moniker? I mean, obviously it's named after the Kate Jackson and Farrah Fawcett, after the TV show, but how, do you know what was the genesis of that?
No, because I wasn't around when it started.
Okay.
I know that when I first came to his office, you know, somebody would call me a Charlie's Angel, and I would say, if you want to live a long and fruitful life, you will not do that.
So what was the reaction? On one hand, you could see it's very demeaning. On the other hand, you could see it's very proud. It's a name that a group
was
attached to.
But it wasn't. I mean, it was demeaning if you, you know, just thought of us as, you know, airheads. But if you really look at the context of Charlie's Angels, we're very tough women. Mm-hmm. The women who worked in Charlie's office were a very strong crew of women, and very capable. Mm-hmm. And you know, but the thing about all of us that I think was clear was that Charlie never disrespected us in any way. He would have never made a pass at us. He would have never. He would have never said anything that would have been inappropriate. Hmm. Now, I can't say that about all members. but you know, he knew what our capabilities were, and he trusted us. Mm-hmm. And so, if we were his fighters, then the name fits, doesn't it? And we got things done for him. Mm-hmm. So he'd send us out on our. Mm-hmm. On our job, and we did it very effectively.
Now, as you mentioned, still hanging out, are the angels still a solid group that gets together or
we
communicates just, with each
we,
other?
We communicate with each other all the time, and we had lunch. We had a little Charlie's Angels lunch last week. Should have been there.
Would have loved
to. If I could teach my class, I'd have been here in a minute.
Very much so. Well, why is that? What all keeps you together? Was it just the fact that, oh, we were all coworkers?
No. I mean, I have a lot of coworkers I don't talk to. I think because in that office we really became friends. Mm-hmm. And we could trust each other, and we could count on each other, and we.
And did Charlie have a role in that?
Sure, he did. He treated us like we were friends. Mm-hmm. He never assigned us that I am the ruling, you know, governing body around here. I think he would have, had he needed to, but nobody. You know, he didn't need to. But he treated us all like we had value, and not one over the other, because we all had our role. Mm-hmm.
And you worked with Peyton Walters.
Oh, yes.
Quite often. Did that extend to Peyton? And
favorite.
As far as, was he like just an extension of Charlie in the office?
No.
Or?
No. Peyton was his own sort of quiet guy who, if you had a problem, you went to Peyton and you talked it over with him, and you said, okay, this is what I need from Charlie, and I know he's busy, what do you think? And he'd say, well, if you can handle it, it might be better. And you'd think about it, and you'd think, okay, can I, and how can I? And, you know, it saved Charlie a lot of time if he didn't have to get wrapped up in some of the things that we dealt with on committees or.
So what was it like then, not only to work for Charlie, but in this case, what is it like to work for Peyton?
Peyton was the best man ever.
What do you mean by that?
Just because he's such a kind and thoughtful and gentle soul. He there is never an unkind moment, ever, with Peyton. He's a prince. you never run into people like that, really.
We were doing this project and put the very thing together. You just say to Peyton, this is what we would like to happen. He said, okay, we'll make it happen.
Well, I think the other thing, too, that I would say about Peyton is that if you did something and you helped him in some way, he never failed to say thank you. A lot of people will let you help them, but they never remember that you helped them. Mm-hmm. And Peyton always says thank you.
As we say in Texas, he's good people.
He's very good people.
Very much so.
He is. Yes.
Very much so. Do you have a favorite memory, fondest memory, story that you're willing to share with you and Charlie?
Well, my favorite memory of Charlie is really talking him out of diving into the Seine River. I have to be honest, that was just something that has stuck with me my entire life. Mm-hmm. But I can tell you that at committee meetings, you know, I would be sitting behind him, and he'd be sitting there, and pretty soon he'd write something, and he'd pass me a note. And, you know, keep in mind that we're friends now.
Yeah.
So he'd say, girl in green, on left, great gams. Yes, of course. So,
I need to look.
You are.
So then I would say, prefer chicken blue, look left. I mean, you had to break these meetings up. They were endlessly long. So that's one of my favorite memories of Charlie.
If there's something you always wanted to ask Charlie that you never did.
No. Anything I wanted to ask Charlie, I asked him.
So what would you say to him today?
And none of your business.
Fair enough.
No, Charlie and I were friends. You have to keep that in mind. There was very little I didn't say to him, which is when he would tell me I wasn't his mother.
Since you were, and y'all did have a relationship, we've asked a lot of people, nobody can put their fingers on this. Charlie was an acknowledged expert. I mean, you'd have to say so in the Afghanistan situation.
Yes.
Everything went through.
Well, on a lot of things, though.
Even though he was out of Congress.
On Pakistan as well.
And we're going through all of this situation in the same area after 9/11. Did anyone from the Bush administration ever reach out to him?
As far as I know, yes.
They did?
Oh, yes. They did?
Well, as far as I understand, he was reached out to, and I don't right now remember who it was.
But somebody did, at least ask him for his counsel.
Yes. Yes.
Well, they obviously didn't take it. But.
No. No, they didn't. And I know Garner, Jay Garner, spoke with him.
Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
When he was going over to Iraq, he spoke with General Garner.
Is that right? Wouldn't we all like to have been privy to that conversation?
You should talk to General Garner.
That's right. We can. I don't know if he would tell us. He might.
I don't know that.
Yeah. I don't know if he would tell us, but he might. Don't know.
What was Charlie's take on events going on in Afghanistan? We asked about this, but you read some of the media attention about Charlie, and you forget how much he wanted to get aid to Afghanistan, but you get these crazy attacks that seem to attack Charlie for what blew up after 9/11 or took place after 9/11.
Well, I think that's because some people, without having any historical context to draw on, forget that, you know, the Mujahideen at that time were not Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
And they now equate them as being the same, mm-hmm. when in fact they were not.
Yeah.
Some became Al-Qaeda, I'm sure. But that was an easy way to say there was a Democrat who gave them Stinger missiles, mm-hmm. and so now let's blame it all on Charlie. I mean, how ignorant do you have to be to
go
there?
How did he react? Did he ever say anything to you about that? Because, I mean, on a very simple level, I think it would just hurt.
I don't think so. I mean, I don't think so. I don't think you can go back and relive those moments. He did a very good thing. Mm-hmm. He did a very good thing, and he knew he did a good thing. To always be able to predict if you gave your 16-year-old a car for his birthday and, you know, 2 years later he drove it into a river doesn't mean you could have predicted that, or mm-hmm. you shouldn't have given him the car for his birthday.
Mm-hmm. Now, his friend, during all those years, did you know what he was doing, what was going on? Did he ever talk to you about it?
Are you talking in the 80s?
In the 80s, when it's going on.
No.
Did you have a sense of something that was going on?
I didn't live here.
Okay.
I did not live here.
Okay.
I left. I was in New York for a while and then in L.A. So when I would talk to him, it was just friendly. Mm-hmm. It wasn't about, you know, are you saving the world this week?
Yeah.
Being black.
Had I known he was saving the world, I surely would have asked you.
Hey.
Could you fill me in on the saving of the world?
Yeah, sure. But so he was very good about the not speaking about this, being...
Well, I mean, you have to understand that, I mean, if something is top secret, it's top secret. You just don't discuss it. Mm-hmm. Even if you read it in the New York Times, you don't mm-hmm. discuss it. Mm-hmm. And that's got to be the way it is.
Now, going from the relationship from Jerry and then before Barbara, what was his relationship like with Joanne Herring?
Again, he thought a lot of her. He really liked her, but I was not around for that part of his. I wasn't around as frequently during that part of his adventure. Mm-hmm. So I don't really know. Mm-hmm. But when I spoke to him about her, he was very fond of her. Mm-hmm. Very fond of her.
Okay.
You never met her.
Oh, sure.
Oh, you did?
Of course.
True impression. We've interviewed her, so.
Well, I mean, I don't know her. The way I would see her wouldn't reflect probably accurately on Joanne or what. It wouldn't, because I don't know her. I only know this role and her relationship with him in a very peripheral way.
Is there something we haven't asked you? You saying you guys are asking the right ask?
You haven't asked me.
Well, what have we not asked that we should have asked?
Well,
and answer them.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, really. I don't know, but I mean there are things that come to me. Mm-hmm. Charlie knew the importance of what he did. He knew. And he treated it reverently, in spite of the fact that he behaved irreverently. It really was something that was so important to him. And he never took it lightly.
Do you think he was ever... I can never think of Charlie... I've never met him, just from listening to people talking about it, I can't imagine him being afraid. But... that he would ever have some trepidation that sometimes some of the behavior would overshadow and keep him from accomplishing what he thought was very important.
I'm certain that he must have had those moments. But Charlie was a survivor, and he would pick himself up and just keep moving. I think all of us have seen Charlie in contemplative moments. There are just things that are too personal that, you know, I wouldn't feel comfortable talking about with you. But I certainly he assessed himself, and then he'd laugh about it, and he'd say, "But you know."
Some people that we've interviewed have suggested that he could get down on himself. Mm-hmm. And actually get, if not morose, really close to it. Did you ever observe that at all, or?
Again, you've talked to other people about that. I think they've told you what you need to hear.
Okay. It's fair.
Yeah. Charlie was, in every way, just a genuinely good friend. He really was. And he was so smart that it was a little scary sometimes, you know. And exhausting. Exhausting. Because I didn't want to know, have to know that much about an Apache helicopter, you know? I didn't. And he loved Deanna Tendall, who had worked for him. And he kept saying to me, she knew everything about that Apache helicopter. Why can't you? And I had a terrible way of saying to these people who would come in to brief me, I would say, could you not tell me that it could kill anybody, but just tell me what its deterrent ratio is, and then
I was going to ask you, how did you deflect or reconcile yourself to doing this job, given what you said you were a committed pacifist?
Well, I'm a military brat, number one.
Is that right?
I have an enormous and deep respect for our military. But I never want anybody to get killed either. No, I mean, truthfully, I sort of made a, I don't want to say a game, but in a way, I really would say, please don't tell me how many people this can kill. Would you just tell me its deterrent factor, and then let's talk about how much funding it needs. Don't tell me the other stuff. And we would go up into the Capitol, you know, in the big room with the big thick door and the code to get in, and boy, what a place. And they would say, okay, now this is a need to know, and I would say, then can I be excused because I don't want to know this? I promise you I have no need to know. And they would say, Kathleen, sit down. But, you know, I did this too because Charlie, you know, thought it was charming. I mean, he let me get away with it.
Sure.
He didn't. He only got mad at me once.
Is that right? And what was that over?
Well, you have to... I didn't come into this knowing the protocol. I came into it knowing the people. But so if I wanted to call over to DOD, I called the Secretary of Defense.
Wow.
Because I knew him. And then, you know, and that would present problems because then you'd get a call back and they would say, you know, we're the Office of Legislative Affairs. You know, you're supposed to call the, you know, the... And I would say, but I don't know her. Mm-hmm. And I do know him, so why would I call you?
Yeah.
And he finally said to me one day, Kathy Ann, you have got to do this in an orderly way. I would think... It's just not built that way, Charlie. So,
well, it worked.
It did. We worked. We did. But we were a good team. And when he would tell me he wanted something done, I would try and get it done. The way that I met Jay Garner was I was at a hearing with Charlie, and we were talking about upgrading Hueys, and the Army wanted Blackhawks, and when it was over, I looked at Charlie and I said, so how many Hueys do you want upgraded? He says, 6. So I went over to Garner and I said, how about we make a trade? I'll give you a Blackhawk if you'll upgrade 6 Hueys for me. And Garner looked at me and he says, who are you? I said, I work for Charlie Wilson. And he said, well, that explains a lot. I had to learn, you know. I had to learn.
Yeah.
He was very tolerant. He really was.
If you were to describe Charlie in just a word or two, what would it be?
He was a friend. He was a really true blue good friend. Dad. And we miss him.
He seemed to inspire a great deal of loyalty in everybody around him as well.
He was loyal to you. You were loyal to him. And you knew you could count on him. Yeah. Honestly, you did. Yeah. You did.
I mean, sometimes we don't realize how rare that is.
I think you're right there. When it's been 10 years ago that my brother was murdered. And one of the first people who called me after this happened was Charlie. He called. I mean, he knew. And I got cancer. One of the first people who called me was Charlie. And then throughout my treatment, he called. Every week, he would call. How are you doing? I know this is hard. How are you doing? Is there anything you need? So he just had such a good heart. Mm-hmm. He had a true blue good heart. And he was just a really good person. And a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's there you go. As well. I wish I'd have met him. I'd like to have had fun with him. So.
Well, I'm sorry you didn't meet him.
I am too. We just came along too late.
Well, not to prematurely end this, but we're about, I guess, at the point where we should logically wrap up as we got another interview coming.
Well, go for it.
But thank you so much.
This has been fun.
This is very insightful.
If we can think of anything else, it's okay to call you.
Absolutely.